Corps and spent 17 years here. All my children are Corconians. They're all from the north side. My husband is from West Cork. I'm going to be to Cork Point. A few years ago, when we had that absolutely glorious summer, I spent a week down in Bantry. And it was absolutely fabulous, but halfway through I got so homesick. And this poem came out of that. Walking from the square to the West Lodge Hotel, Bantry, in a heat wave. Blue bottle summer. Fierce heat bounces off the houses across the harbour. The pavement burns through my sandals. The tide is out. Fish scales and diesel shimmer on the pier. Tied up with blue polyprop, a clinker-built wreck sinks into the slough under a bladder-wreck astrakhan. Tarmac, softened toffee, sucks at passing cars. To my right, a hill where bullocks lumber under dusty hedgerows. Green meadows surround the town, shadowed under ash and sycamore. On the road out of here, crows unsettle in the crown of a beach. The burial ground nudges the golden strand. The verges hum, white clover sweeps the air. I could be home. This next poem came out of my brother was in Yosemite, and he kept on talking about wolves. And apparently, if the junior wolves, if they want to have any kind of life of their own, they have to leave the pack, otherwise they have to obey the alpha male on the top bench all the time. So this poem was inspired by my idea of one of these lone females heading off looking for a mate. But it's also, I think, about finding my voice as a poet, which I only did a few years ago, really. Self-portrait as she-wolf. You shear away from the warm, many-tailed beast, spurn the communal dream. Beyond the shelter of pine and fir, you lope across open ground, where cold scalds your lungs. Feel a soft-nosed bullet's kiss. Lick the salt wound clean. Almost drown in a starry bog. But break through its dark mirror. Meet your reflection in a boutique window on a city street. Among mannequins in ersatz furs. The last of your kind, or the first. Only look back once for a silhouette, a hungry scent. There is still time to retrace your spoor, answer the tribal howl. Your throat opens on one long swooped syllable, almost a word. This next poem is the one that won the Gregory O'Donohoe Award, and it's the title poem of the collection. When I was a child, the hare figured a lot in my life. I think she's my animal spirit. And my granddad used to take me for walks just to get me out of the way from home. And he was very, very old, and he used to get me to sit down. He'd snooze if I'd stay quiet. And the thing to keep me quiet, he used to tell me, watch the hare, she was sitting on her form. And I'd see her change into a calyuk. And I thought the calyuk was the name of the hare. But I never saw her change. I'd blink and she'd have changed back into a hare again. Just when I was blinking. Dreadful. Self-portrait in the convex bulge of a hare's eye. My first word for hare was calyuk, witch or crone, slack-skinned hag with blade-edged bones. I met her again today where seven hare sisters grazed a scrawny field at Renfile. Face to face inhaled her leapest breath, gazed through my shadow face, cupped in her glass dark eye. Which is my animal shade? I asked the coven of leathern ears. Each licked her cloven lip and chanted, I, and I. Hair with seesawed tongue rolled the dark bulge of her eye, answered, all of us here. We show no map of your journey. We are you when you get there. I grabbed at Scutton's slippery ear, begged her to tell more. But rain rolled in for Buffin. Plump drops slipped her fur. She twitched a sole-crested whisker, slipped into otherwhere. Like a white horse in Kjodrifa, left me straddling a barbed wire fence with two handfuls of loose belly skin and a jagged gash in my thigh. Poem is dedicated to my mother, who was a very enterprising woman. I remember when we were very young, we were snowed in once for weeks. It was one of those terrible winters that come kind of every 20 years or so. And my father, of course, was saying we'd be ruined because we didn't expect this winter, so we didn't have enough fodder for the animals, and we had to put them into the forest. You know, for shelter, we didn't have enough housing for them, and so we were going to be ruined. And of course, I was picking up on this and thinking, really, the end of the world was coming. Portrait of the artist's mother as a Merlin. I woke once to a cold house. We were snowbound, running low on wood and cow nuts, and out of cocoa. It was my task to warn my mother when the fire burned low, and perhaps I wanted her hands to gentle my hair into braids and comfort the baby. And so I went outside and called her name in cowyard, barn, and across the blank fields, and heard the dead silence of snow. I came on her out of sight of the house, perched on a weathered, broken chair, steam rising about her in a cloud, her enormous green eyes fixed on a fresh-killed hen she clutched by its claws. Her left hand plunged the carcass in a steaming bucket, and the hand that stirred soup and soothed the baby stripped feathers from the breast and dropped them onto the snow. From my corner of the yard, I watched her white breaths, her hands tearing feathers from flesh, flurries of down drifting around her head like bloodied snow, catching on straws and the barbs of blackthorns. I was very young, made anxious by overheard talk of ruin and hunger and a long winter, and it helped that day to know that out of sight of the nest, my mother became a wild thing, a Merlin at her plucking post. Whenever I live very close to the sea, very, very close to the sea now, but I've always lived within a few miles of it. And whenever I'm anywhere on holiday or around the country, I always go for a walk if I'm near the sea, somewhere alone along the cliffs or promenade or whatever. And there's always another woman there looking out to sea on her own. And I've tried to imagine what her story would be. This poem is that imagining. And all the names I've given her have something to do with the sea. Woman of the Atlantic seaboard. You might meet her anywhere on the coast. At Moher, she is Rosemary, walks the high cliffs away from the buses and tour guides, her face turned towards the west, sea in her head. Or at Renville, where a white carved stone remembers the unbaptized, as Maiden Mora, she keeps vigil where the sea stole their bones from the shore. Call her Atlantia, she who waits in the lee of a seawall at Vigo for the boats to come in. She looks deep into fishermen's eyes, as if eyes can give back what they've seen, a waterlogged husband, brother's shin bone, a son's lobster trap ribcage to carry home in a pocket of her yellow oilskin, enough for a burial. She is Marinella on Cabo Espichel, Morwenna in Wales, among wild women who comb blueberry barrens in Maine. She is Maris, her fingers long as the sea's ninth wave, stained for plucking sharp fruit in sea fog. Find her on shore where Connemara ponies ride out the surf. Take her home. Give her the stranger's place at the hearth. She won't stay. Inland, she adds salt to her bath. Boils potatoes in seawater down to a salt crust. Feed her dillisk and carry moss. She can't help but return to the waves, to kelp and ozone. She is moraine, born at sea. The sea salts her blood. Or call her Thalassa, mother of kelpies, selkies, fin-flippered sea mammals, neoprene-skinned fish hunters, creatures of the tide. All lost to her, Oceania, the seafarer's daughter, sister, mother, wife. On a widow's walk in Boston, she scans the horizon for a floater or a boat. Meet her on the brink of the ocean, alone, winter seas in her eyes. Call her by any of her names. She will turn from you to the blue nor'wester. Shake brined beads from her hair. She will wait for her drownings forever, standing in the salt rain. I worked in Temple Bar for quite a long time when I moved to Dublin first, and on my way home in the middle of the afternoon, finished early, I used to meet this young woman who was a drug addict, and sometimes she'd be well out of it, but sometimes she'd be compassionate enough to share a cup of tea, and I learned a lot of vocabulary about drugs from her. I also had went on an amazing trip under medical supervision in hospital when they gave me some extra morphine-based drugs, not realizing I'd already had a different morphine-based drug. So that kind of trip found its way in here too. Dreamless. A million crawling things run spider-wise inside her skin. Her skeleton is glass. She needs another hit, and fast. Her skin is needle-tracked. She works the streets for heroin to stop the spider things. She does a punter in a dash against a fence and scores a 30-second rush. Glass splinters in her veins fuse into a waterfall of raindrops. Magic light spills from her fingertips. She's blissed out, dreaming weightless, while the good brown horse outruns her dream. She's goofing now, slumped outside a church, between her knees a paper cup she holds out like a sacred heart to passers-by. Small change spills through her fingertips, but not enough. Another stranger in a car earns her more dreams. She sucks her tongue for spit to swallow fear, swears on the sacred heart that she'll get clean, then mugs the punter with a syringe. Again spiderlings crisscross her skin and crawl inside her arm tracks. two blowjobs on her knees to get a hung. She cooks the gear, a bag of china white, loads up a syringe, smacks a vein, ties off and hits. Her hopes are answered with all men. The dragon's knocked brown sugar girl off her horse. The fall has sucked out all her breath. Her eyes are pinned. She feels no crawly things. She has no skin. Her bones are glass. Her heart beats trickle from her fingertips like raindrops when the rain's about to stop. Years ago, I was at a funeral of a cousin, and just as we were going into the service, somebody asked his brother, "You'll do the eulogy, won't you?" And it was very, very short notice. He did a great job, and I will say this to my kids after. And I said to them, "You know, I don't know if anybody else could do a spontaneous eulogy like that. You better start writing mine now." And they said, "Write it yourself, you're the writer." So I said, "Just teach them a lesson, I will." It's very hard to say good things about yourself. So the poem turned into something else. I think there was a lot of talk, it was winter time, and you know, every October, November, there's a campaign to remind people of all the people who have gone missing, and see if it will spark any new information that might lead to them being found. That was in my head at the time, quite a bit, so this poem is dedicated to all the missing. Missing. I am in a quiet grove in a city park, on a curved bench in a winter night. I am in a profile on a dating site, in a Sunday crowd on Grafton Street, on a midland bog, under shifting dunes, among Sitka roots in a Wicklow wood, in a council drain. I am in the tramp and suck of hiking boots on a sheep track through a distant hill, under heather raked flat by a forest tank, in the wind's breath, in a still lake. I am in a garth fire, a requiem mass, a month's mind, the open verdict of the coroner's inquest. I am in a glimpse from a passing truck of letters carved on a roadside cross at a black spot, in plastic wreaths and ranked toy bears. I am in the SOS cut short by wires yanked from a phone kiosk. In the dark hour lost when the clock goes back. I am on weathered posters, in a snapshot from a photo booth, in the night train's whistle, the wind's harp notes in the cable stays of a Dublin bridge. Under your forehead bone, in the seahorse coils where memory lives, whisper my name. I have not disappeared. Short poem. A couple of years ago, we went on, my husband and I went on a winter trip to the Cade Fields, where there's nobody there. It's all closed and you have to climb over the fence. And the interpretive centre is all shut up. I hate those places with an engine. So I had the place all to myself, and climbed down a cliff nearby, and it occurred to me that, you know, a lot of other women must have done this before me. This is becoming the ancestor. As in prehistory, a woman climbed down these wave-fretted cliffs and stretched to rest on this shore. So lay your cheek on this time-worn stone, and looking north along longitude 9, to where the blue wind splits sea from sky, follow its trajectory from that birthing point to your curious eye. So learn, as she may have done, how this earth curves and time. Revenge poem. This poem is the title we tell you. It's about all the women who were accused of being witches, but really they were just free spirits or herbal healers. And a lot of the vocabulary in it is to do with medicinal plants, which can of course also be poisonous if they're misused. Three sisters. Quick graft my floating rib to a spur of the quicken tree, so my spirit endures as strong as the day I was born, for I must destroy the destroyers of Bella, Donna, and me. Bella was 15 and skilled in the remedy for the man's complaint. For her healing hand she was burned, but I spliced her wishbone to a spur of the quicken tree. Gossip said good sister Donna left wifing for witchery, damned her as devil's whore when she bore the six-fingered bear. I raked the pyre for her bones. Burners of Bella and Donna knew me as mild, the youngest, a child. I smiled, hid my ferocity. Seducers, goodwives, magistrates came to strange harm while I tended my sisters on the stalk of the quicken tree. Threaded rosaries of devil's cherry to garland each nursery, shrank men's acorns to sloes, stilled babes in the womb. Destroyers of Bella and Donna, you almost destroyed me. But on bonfire eve, six-fingered boys set me free with tincture of nightshade and yew seed in witchbane tea. He grafted my floating rib to a spur of the quicken tree. Now we three unite as destroyers, Bella, Donna, and me. I suppose that even nowadays everybody learns the story of the children of Lir in school. It always struck me as very unfair that, you know, the story ended when they came back and it was all Christianized and they heard the bell of the church and became Christians and died happy. But I wanted to look at the story from the point of view of Aoife, the stepmother, the second wife's tale. I wanted his gold at my throat, wanted Lir's mouth-filling, tongue-filling mine. I sooted my lashes, red-berried my lips, smiled till my jaw cracked and wet on smiling. My breath wild mint in his ear, my hand a bird on his thigh. He married my sister. When she died, a great winging like swans swelled the silence inside me. Four children pined for their mother, Lir for his wife. I'm no mother, no matter. I soothed Lir's wife ache. This was my sorrow. The river flows both ways. She carries away what she can take, man or woman, her child not grown to reason. She turns at the moon's demand, her freshened waters full of the swimming of white swans, glass eels, sea trout, salmon. I come from the literal. Water shaped me. Men danced for my notice. Lir made me second wife, I who was river weed. He thought I had not a mean bone in my body. This was the second sorrow. Four wedges between me and my husband.
allured Lyra's children to water, left them to float as waterfowl. I am Aoife, mean through to the marrow. When you speak of Lyra's signets, tell of my punishment, banished to winter 900 years. Say winter's cold was her only dread, now she's frozen to her marrow bones. Say ice grows where she holds her breath, her voice is in the north wind's teeth. When she breathes, the blizzard shrieks. Say swans go swaddled and feathers them down, but Aoife has only her own fine skin between her flesh and the bitter wind. This is the greatest sorrow.